Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of Mitt Romney's speech to the cadets at VMI that was billed as his vision for a new national security strategy. We will speak with Lawrence Korb, who was an Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Then we'll examine a new report by the IMF warning that the global economic recovery is slowing and that growth rates in 2013 will be less than earlier projections. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research, joins us to discuss how austerity is slowing growth, particularly in the UK, which the IMF singled out. But nevertheless, Republican deficit hawks keep insisting Americans need a dose of austerity to prevent the country from falling off the fiscal cliff. Then finally, we will look into a lawsuit filed by the Ohio Democratic Party against Murray Energy, whose owner coerced the company's coal miners to appear as a backdrop for a Mitt Romney rally in Ohio. The lawsuit was stimulated by an article in the New Republic, Coal Miners Donor, a Mitt Romney benefactor and his surprisingly generous employees. The author of the article, Alec McGillis, a senior editor at the New Republic, joins us. Joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Good to be with you.
So, what did you make of President, he's not president yet, even though the polls indicate, they indicate he's on a roll, Mitt Romney. What did you make of his speech at VMI, where he was supposed to outline a new vision for national security, but essentially, as far as I could tell, there's not a lot of difference, frankly, between him and President Obama's strategy. So he seemed to be more or less trying to paint Obama as the president who leads from behind without really offering anything different from what Obama's national security policy is.
Well, yeah, in many cases. I mean, for example, you know, he talked about the fact that in Afghanistan, he would keep the 2014 deadline. He criticized Obama for not pushing to keep troops in Iraq, but he didn't say he would. And, you know, Obama had no choice because, Prime Minister Maliki wouldn't give them immunity. He seemed to be indicating that Obama, and he used the term leading from behind, was allowing events to spin out of control in the Middle East without saying what he would do. Would he not want to have a member of the Islamic Brotherhood win the election in Egypt? He talked about the fact that he would sort of, if you will, give aid and comfort to the good guys in Syria. The problem is we don't know who the good guys is, and once you put the equipment in there, you don't know where it's going to end up. And he seemed to indicate that Obama's, quote-unquote, weak policies were responsible for what happened in Libya without mentioning, you know, the fact that basically what happened in Libya was only tangentially connected to Al-Qaeda. I mean, he sort of gave Obama credit for getting bin Laden, but then he said, oh, it was the military and intelligence people, you know, that deserved the credit. So he wasn't that much different, but he was trying to portray the fact that he would be more robust without, you know, telling us what that would do. He said he would have crippling sanctions on Iran. Well, you already got crippling sanctions on Iran.
Well, I understand the critique on the left against President Obama, who has authorized six times as many drone strikes than George W. Bush did against Pakistan, and he's the first American president to authorize the assassination of a U.S. citizen. That's fairly well understood, but so how do you launch an attack on the right against him? I noticed that Obama recently said that, you know, if Romney thinks we should get into more wars, then he owes it to the American people to explain. And we know that he's made bellicose statements about needing to have a tougher stand against Iran and against Syria. But it looks as though he's pivoting away from that now. He seems to be backing off the idea of falling into that trap. And of course, that would be a trap for him in the next presidential debate, surely.
Yes, it would be. I think what happened is, you know, he felt he had to give a foreign policy speech, even though he's been focusing on the economy. So he tried to portray the Democrats as weak, which had been the traditional Republican response. And it just didn't go over at all, because, as you say, Obama's main criticisms come not from the right, but from the left, because I think a lot of people who supported him were surprised when he tripled the number of troops in Afghanistan. And as you say, you know, really stepped up the drone strikes.
So it's pretty clear, though, isn't it, Lawrence Korb, that the American public they don't want any more wars, particularly in Muslim lands.
No, they don't. And, I mean, there's no, you know, as one general told me, he said, if you like Iraq, you'll love Syria, you know, if you want to get in there. And then, of course, you know, Iran is a country of 80 million people. Even if you bomb them, you know, you're going to have to at some point invade them to follow up, because they're not just going to sit still and, you know, take the bombing and do nothing.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. So, you mentioned Syria. He sort of danced around Syria. He said that he would identify and organize those members of the opposition who share our values and ensure they obtain the arms that they need to defeat Assad's tanks, helicopters, and fighter jets. But he did not directly say that his administration would arm the Syrian rebels. So, again, is he just backing away from... Is this just like the first debate where he was a completely different guy from all of the things that he'd been saying on the campaign trail for the last 18 months? In other words, he went after the right wing Tea Party vote, and then suddenly showed up as a moderate, and now he's trying to back away from his earlier statements that he wants to get tough on Iran and tough on Syria.
Yeah, there's no doubt about the fact that he, having won the nomination, does not want to turn off the American people, as you said, who are tired of war. And so he's trying to portray himself as different from Obama. But if you read it closely, it's not that, you know, different. And in fact, to the extent that he is different, it is going to, you know, antagonize a lot of the American people. I mean, you know, the if you will, the factions in Syria that share our values basically are getting arms already from the Arab League and the Saudis. So, and he didn't say he would give them, so I don't know where exactly he would, you know, expect them to come from.
And of course, he said that he would prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons capability and would not hesitate to put more sanctions on Iran. But as you've pointed out, Lawrence Korb, the Iranian economy is in free fall. Its currency has plunged in value as much as 80% against the dollar since the beginning of the year. And we don't know. I mean, this may well be in the next few weeks. Things may. It's clearly changed the calculus. I noticed that Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is not calling for the military strikes that he's been rattling the saber over. So, you know, that, at least in the case of Netanyahu, seems to the fact that the Iranian economy is in such distress seems to have undercut Netanyahu's argument that the sanctions aren't working, surely.
Yeah, it really has. And, you know, Netanyahu also faces tremendous opposition including from the president of Israel, Peres, as well as, you know, his military and intelligence people who are saying, okay, you bomb, you won't get it all, and you'll create, you know, more problems. And I think the interesting thing, Netanyahu has just called for, you know, elections, which means it's obviously he's not going to do anything in the near term.
So what struck me most in this speech that Romney gave to the Virginia Military Institute about his national security strategy, and of course it's a kind of prelude to the subject matter for the second debate on October the 16th. The thing that I found extraordinary was that Romney said that the size of our Navy is at levels not seen since 1916. Now, what is he talking about?
Well, I think this is something that he got from the Pentagon. Secretary Panetta, who was trying to prevent sequestration, said, if you have the cuts under sequestration, our Navy will be smaller than any time since 1916. A couple of things that are important about that. Actually, it was smaller in 2005 than it was. It's bigger now than it was in 2005. The other is it's bigger than the next 11 navies in the world combined. And, of course, you can't equate a modern, you know, Gerald Ford aircraft carrier with some of the things that you had in 1916. No, I mean, that's just, it's one of those things that, you know, that get people's attention, like, oh, we're going to cut defense $1 trillion. Well, they don't say that's over 10 years and it's going to cut it, you know, from, you know, 6 trillion to 5 trillion. It's not that they're, you know, not going to be spending it. Yeah, I mean, that's where he got that from. And to the people who don't, you know, look very closely, they'll say, oh my goodness, that was before World War One. We don't want to go back there. Well, again, you're not going back. I mean, you've got one aircraft carrier today is as powerful as the entire Navy was in 1916.
And we have 11 aircraft carriers.
That's correct.
And we have the battle groups that go along with them. Then we have submarines, each one of which could wipe out, you know, China or Russia, or all of which could wipe out the entire planet.
That's right. I mean, you know, you have a Trident submarine has 24, you know, missiles on board, each of which has multiple warheads. So you could launch, you know, 250 nuclear weapons from one submarine.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. So, following the speech at VMI that was billed by the Romney campaign as his unveiling his national security strategy and showing how different he is from President Obama, it seems that he fell flat in both areas. But given his performance in the debate, which has been translated into tremendous gains in the poll, and particularly in the swing states, now he's even pulling up in Ohio. So what do you expect, Lawrence Korb, from this second debate? I imagine everybody on the Democratic side has been sending their unsolicited advice to the White House, telling Obama to get his act together.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt about the fact that, you know, because Romney did so well and Obama did so badly in the debate that people are taking a second look at Romney. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, the Romney they saw in the debate is not the one that we've seen on the campaign trail, you know, in terms of the positions that he took. So I think you'll probably will see the vice presidential debate this year will be more significant than it has in the past. And, you know, Obama has two more chances, to basically, you know, present his view. It reminds me of, you know, I was in government in the Reagan administration, as you mentioned, and in the first debate with Mondale, I mean, Reagan almost looked like he was senile. I don't know if you remember, he was talking about getting lost on the Pacific Coast Highway, and my goodness, you know, but he came back in the second debate, and then, of course, he won 49 out of 50 states.
Well, but then you can contrast it with the debate against Jimmy Carter, the one and only debate against Jimmy Carter.
That's right.
Where Reagan was way behind in the polls, and suddenly after that debate, he took a lead and won the presidency.
Well, he did, and that's, you know, I mean, if remember, that debate was like just a couple of days before the election. If that were the only debate, I think Obama would be in a lot of trouble. The one thing that's happened since the debate, though, I think will help him is unemployment going below 8%. And of course, that had been one of Romney's lines, you know, 43 months of, unemployment above 8%. So that'll be a little hard to, you know, for him to continue to use that line.
So what's your sense, though, then about the sequestration and the idea that the sky is falling, particularly at the Pentagon? And when my understanding is that if the sequestration goes through, the cuts to the Pentagon will only take it back to where it was in 2007.
That's correct. In real terms, controlling for inflation, yeah. And we'll still have 40% of the world's military expenditures, and the all these companies are not going to have to lay off people because the Pentagon has $90 billion in money that's been authorized but not obligated, so they can reduce that. Plus, our defense companies had 87% of the foreign military sales last year, which was like $66 billion. That's about $150 billion that they can take, you know, the cuts out of there without disturbing any of the existing contracts.
So do you think then that this hard line that Romney's been pursuing in the campaign still resonates, or do you have a sense, as many do, that the American people are war-weary and that they wouldn't mind a cut in defense because they're quite concerned about Social Security and Medicare and other domestic programs that are being threatened?
Oh, yeah, I think the Americans are war-weary. When you tell them how much we spend on defense and what proportion of the world's military expenditures, oh, yeah, they're more than willing. Even Republicans are, you know, when you give them the data. So, no, that the issue is not going to be decided. You know, in other words, people are not going to vote for Romney because they want a more aggressive foreign policy or want to spend $2 trillion more in defense over the next decade. They're going to vote because they don't think that Obama, you know, has a plan to, you know, keep improving the economy or that he's up to the job. And that's why I think it's important in the second and third debates for him to show that, you know, he, you know, has a plan and that we're on the right track.
Well, but he has to. The Obama that shows up on October the 16th has at least got to be an alpha male like Romney was. I mean, Romney was so aggressive and on like a salesman frantically trying to close a deal. And Obama was kind of lackadaisical. And I think a lot of people were concerned that, you know, if you can't stand up to this venture capitalist doing a sales pitch, how can you stand up to Putin? I mean, he's got a man up, doesn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it. He really has to, and he has to bring his A game in the next debate, and because Romney kept coming back at him, and I think President Obama was trying to appear presidential, and of course, it came across as weak, and it looked to me like, you know, he kept looking down instead of right into the camera, you know, kind of basic things. And, of course, you know, if you're president, he hadn't debated in quite a while, or Romney has been, you know, doing it, quite a bit.
Sure.
So, anyway, I think he knows now what he has to do. And I have every confidence that I think he'll show in the next two debates that he, you know, he's going to move us in the right direction, and certainly in a better direction than Romney is trying to do.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Lawrence Korb.
Okay, good to be with you.
Good to be with you again. Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction.
Come, you masters of war, here that build the big guns, Yeah, that build the death planes. Yeah, that build all the bombs. Yeah, that hide behind walls. Yeah, that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Ready as heavy as can be. Tell everybody waiting for Superman that they should try to hold on the best they can.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the new report from the IMF that says global economic recovery is weakening. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest ebook is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And today the IMF issued a report on how the global economic recovery is weakening. They added that there's a risk of further deterioration, that the economic outlook had, in fact, was the possibility of getting worse was considerable. And they downgraded global growth for 2013 from to 3.6% from the 3.9% forecast they did in July. How should we react to this? Is this news to you?
Well, it's the recognition by the IMF of these facts is perhaps news to me. I mean, the economy, the world economy, is clearly very weak, and basically the IMF is acknowledging what I think is just very obviously true. And what was perhaps most striking was, you know, a bit of honesty here, that they said this is really very much man-made, in the sense that the austerity policies that we're seeing across much of the world, certainly in the Eurozone and the UK, these are a big factor. They said they underestimated the extent to which they would be a drag on growth. And, you know, it's good they're pointing that out, and hopefully they'll put more pressure on governments to change those policies.
Well, indeed, the biggest downgrade was to the U.S. economy, which the IMF expects to shrink by 0.4% this year. And that of course, is the country where the most austerity, the biggest dose of austerity has been meted out. Is this likely to affect the political debate here in the United States in terms of particularly the conservatives in Congress, in the House, who talk about the fiscal cliff, and presumably after this election, the whole idea of the looming deficits will be revisited?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's not going to have a lot of impact. I mean, the IMF, this is true of other international organizations like the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they have much more influence in other countries. So it wouldn't be uncommon if we were in France or Germany or something, one of the smaller European countries, in Netherlands or Denmark. If the IMF said, you know, here, your policy is really bad, you know, a politician might get up there and say that, and it would carry a lot of weight. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to bow down and go, okay, we're going to do that. But that would carry a lot of weight. It's very hard to imagine that President Obama or Governor Romney are going to say, oh, the IMF told us this, that, and that, and people might laugh at them. So it really carries a little weight, maybe, in the sense that, you know, we have kind of these intellectual debates and we go, look, even the IMF acknowledges this and that. I'm happy to have them on my side in that sense. But unfortunately, I don't really think this is going to have all that much influence.
Well, is this a case, though, that of reality not impinging on ideology? I mean, you have ample evidence of what austerity's done to England, what it's done to Greece and Spain, where there's over 50% youth unemployment. Angela Merkel has got a very chilly welcome in Greece. The people have quite angry, particularly at the German banks, who have been made whole at the expense of the Greek people. and it just seems fairly obvious that where austerity's been tried, it's failed, and that, you know, Keynes is still alive.
You would think that, and you know, you'd like to think that policies promoting stimulus would have more sway. And again, at least in the U.S., it's a marginal impact. Hopefully, more of an impact elsewhere. But again, you know, again, a lot of people don't want to be convinced. You would think in the U.K., it's almost just straight textbook. It's perhaps a more arguable point in the Eurozone case because you do have this issue that, you know, countries can't unilaterally stimulate their economy. In other words, Greece, you know, it needs the permission. You know, it's like Indiana wants to stimulate its economy. Well, Indiana can't spend money. It needs, you know, it needs permission from the federal government. Essentially, it would have to underwrite it. And that's the way countries, Eurozone countries, the situation they face. But the UK has its own currency. They could just go ahead and run larger deficits. Their interest rate on the debt's extremely low. It's around 1.6%. It's kind of what is in the U.S. If there were any problem of selling their currency, their bonds on the markets, they could have the Central Bank of England buying up. There should not be an issue with them stimulating their economy yet. You know, they have a government that's committed to it, and you know, just inflicting enormous damage, as you say. I mean, if we had an enemy at war who was doing the same sort of damage as you know, our leaders are doing to the UK, to the US, to the Eurozone, you know, we'd be up in arms. Everyone would be enlisting at their local draft office, and you know, we'd be ready to really go at them. But you know, somehow they put on their coats as economists and they say everything's fine.
So the IMF report on the slowdown in economic recovery globally, of course, cites China, China being the engine of global economic growth, and it's slowing down. It would grow 7.8% this year, down from a previous forecast of 8%, and 8.2% next year, down from 8.5%. Previously estimated, and India is in a similar situation as well. How much is the fact that I mean, isn't there a lot of overcapacity in China? Obviously, the European markets are drying up. Is there concern that China, just for domestic political stability, don't they have to? Their economy has to grow. At least that's the way that the Politburo sees it.
Well, It obviously has to grow. I mean, previously, you know, the idea was that to grow 10% rate, and then you had people saying sort of the contradictory thing that they can't maintain that growth rate because they're running out of people, running out of people migrating from the countryside to the cities. Well, of course, if you're running out of people, then you don't have to grow that fast. You know, the argument was, well, you had to grow that fast to maintain full employment, and, you know, I won't call myself an expert in China, but it does stand to reason after a certain point, the rate of flow from the countryside to the city is going to slow. They've had very low population growth over the last decade, so it certainly wouldn't be surprising that, you know, their target rate, what they have to do to maintain something close to, you know, high levels of employment, it would be lower today. So whether 8% will cut it, I can't really say, but it wouldn't surprise me that they could do much better, do it something lower than a 10% rate, which is really extraordinary, especially since they've maintained that for close to three decades now. So I'm not sure that 8% is a disaster. Now, what they do clearly have to do is move towards meeting this more with domestic demand, which in a sense shouldn't really be a problem. Essentially what that means is people have to enjoy higher living standards. So you wouldn't think that one would be that hard to sell. Now, different groups will benefit by that in the sense that there are groups that have, there's industries that are set up to export to the United States, to West Europe, to other countries around the world, and those might not be the same companies that benefit from an increase in domestic demand. So in that sense, you'll have powerful interest who would be unhappy about that. But certainly from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, increasing domestic demand would likely be a good thing. I mean, that would mean rising living standards.
So what explains this emerging spate of China bashing that's going on both in the political campaign where both the Romney and Obama campaign are accusing each other of being soft on the Chinese, in effect. 60 Minutes just did a report on a Chinese company they suspect of being a stealth operation for espionage. Then the Chinese company argues that they just want to put in cheap broadband in the United States. So my understanding is that we need the Chinese to keep buying our treasury bills to finance our deficit on the one hand, but on the other hand, do you think that there's a political price to China bashing?
Well, it's not clear. We actually don't need them to buy our bonds. In fact, President Obama, at least ostensibly, has been asking them not to buy our bonds, because that is, when you hear people saying they manipulate their currency, that's how they do it. They buy our bonds. That's a one and the same act. That's what kind of the absurdity of U.S. politics and economic debates. The way in which they manipulate their currency is by buying U.S. government bonds. So if we're unhappy about them keeping down the value of their currency against the dollar, then we should be unhappy about them buying U.S. government bonds. That is how they do that. So that's more than a little perverse. If they stop buying the bonds, what that would mean is that the dollar would fall against China's currency, our goods would be more competitive, their goods would be more expensive to people in the United States, which would move us towards more balanced trade. And it's important to understand that it wouldn't just be with China. Other countries target their currency against the Chinese currency. So if it were the case that China's currency would rise, say, 20 or 30% against the dollar, you'd probably see something comparable with the Vietnamese currency, the Indian currency, Cambodian, a whole set of currencies through the region. That's been the past pattern. So that would go a long way towards redressing our imbalance in trade. So I think part of this story is based on real grievances we have in China. Some of them don't bother me at all. I couldn't care less if they're making copies of Microsoft software. That's not something that concerns me. I don't own any stock in Microsoft. It ain't my problem. Others, as I said, the currency issue is more real. The point is, just as some businesses benefit there from these things, some businesses benefit here, and that's, I think, the reason why we haven't done anything. People, yell at China. It's really not China has so much power in U.S. politics. It's U.S. corporations like Walmart and General Electric that benefit from cheap labor in China that don't want to give that up. They don't want to see everything that we get from China cost 20 or 30% more. So it's, if we want to bash someone there rather than beating up on the Chinese government, I think the more reasonable targets are probably General Electric and Walmart.
So again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Let's turn to the post-election fiscal cliff that is tied up, of course, in this sequestration vote that was a result of the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party essentially putting the full faith and credit of the United States in jeopardy, having a political tantrum so that they could get their way and essentially carry water for the billionaires who, heavens forbid, the Bush tax cut should end. They went to the mat to stop the Bush tax cut from ending, and thus we got this deal that a lot of people are alarmed about. I spoke with some people recently who said, it's not the end of the world if the defense budget is cut. It'll only go back to what it was in 2007, and frankly, it's almost impossible to cut the defense budget at any rate. This may be a great opportunity, and likewise, the top tax rate would go back from what it is now, 35%, back to what it was under Clinton at 39%, and that's not the end of the world for the billionaires who've made out so well over the last few decades. So what's your reading on whether or not the sequestration, if it happened, would be a catastrophe?
Well, there's a few things. So the sequestration, certainly the issue of the military budget doesn't bother me. As you say, it's bloated. If it gets cut back some, it's around a 10%, a bit less than 10%. It's about 8% cut. It's hardly a disaster. But the domestic side of the budget is about 10%. We would feel that. But an important point about that, what happens in January, and people are making a big issue, we fought, the cliff term is really annoying because it really is not what's going on. It's very little this happens in January, if anything, because it's important to understand what literally happens in January is that we're appropriating less money to be spent beginning January 1st. That has almost nothing to do with how much actually will be spent in the month of January, in the month of February. Those are outlays. Much of that was appropriated last year, this year. So the idea is suddenly we're going to have a huge cut in spending. No, that isn't the case. And particularly if it looks like we're about to negotiate a deal where at least some of that's restored, then there's no reason at all to think there'll be any notable cut in spending come January 1st. On the tax side, important to realize, yeah, the tax rates for the top 2% would go back to the clean air rates, but they would for everyone else as well. That'd be a big tax increase, and that's being coupled at the same time with the end of the payroll tax deduction. Again, January 1st is irrelevant. When they do it January 1st, and that really doesn't matter if they do it January 10th, 15th, January 20th, even if they'd gotten to February, wouldn't be a big deal. But the story of us going into a recession, that assumes that they never fix it. We go all 2013 paying taxes at a higher rate. And given that the economy on the whole is not doing great, if we suddenly saw a big increase in taxes on the order of $500 billion, that would be a hit to the economy. I don't think there's any two ways about it. And I think the story that we go back into a recession, that's very plausible. So getting a deal by January 1st, doesn't matter. You know, it'd probably be nice if we could write down tomorrow, here's what everything's going to look like. But if the price of that were a really bad deal that will extend the Bush tax cuts for another however many years for the rich, I would say that probably isn't worth doing. You know, so it's a negotiating issue. And in the event that President Obama gets reelected, and if he doesn't, it's all kind of moot, I guess. But if he gets reelected, if he were to carry the negotiations into next year, there's not any real bad consequence from that.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog, Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the we're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about how the Democratic Party in Ohio is suing a mine owner who forced his employees to appear at a Romney rally.
We were poor, but we had love. That's the one thing that Daddy made sure of. He shoveled coal to make a poor man's dollar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alec McGillis, who's a senior editor at The New Republic, serving as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, Coal Miner's Donor, a Mitt Romney Benefactor, and His Surprisingly Generous Employees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alec McGillis.
Thank you.
And your article has clearly had an effect here because the Ohio Democratic Party has requested a criminal investigation into the Ohio-based company Murray Energy for allegedly coercing their employees to appear as a backdrop to a Romney rally in Ohio. They're charging Murray with extortion, money laundering, racketeering, and other violations of Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code. What do you think their chances are?
Well, the law in this area is pretty clear, but then there's some gray area around it. Basically, the law says that you cannot, as an employer, you cannot force your employees to contribute to political campaigns. You cannot make that a condition of employment that your workers give to a campaign or to your company political action committee. You also cannot reimburse employees for contributions that they make to the candidates that you wanted them to give to. So that's pretty clear, but then there's a lot of gray area around that having to do with, you know, how do you define forcing, how do you define reimbursing, and so it's probably going to take, someone with, it's going to take investigators looking at this matter, I think, to figure out if there were violations here. What I was able to report simply was that I had sources, company sources, telling me that there was indeed a lot of pressure coming down from the top of the company to employees, urging them to give money to the company PAC and to various national candidates, including Mitt Romney, and also telling me that there was some understanding that the money that they would be spending on this would be made up to them somehow. I was able to back this up with documents from the company, from inside the company, letters from Mr. Murray to employees urging them in very strong terms to give to candidates and to the company PAC, and even some tables and spreadsheets showing how the various company subsidiaries were doing in their participation in the fundraisers, and even a list of employees who were not allegedly not giving, these various ways of putting pressure on people, saying, look, we know who's giving and who's not giving, and you need to step it up.
Well, Alec McGillis, the fact that in the 2010 election, the year that John Boehner became House Speaker, Murray Energy and its 3,000 employees and their families were the second biggest source of funds to John Boehner's campaign. So, AT&T being in first place with its nearly 200,000 employees. So, the idea that 3,000 employees could almost match 200,000 employees of AT&T, something's working there, isn't it, at Murray Energy for the Republicans?
Oh, certainly. This is Murray Energy has just been a remarkably big source of contributions for the Republicans for some time now. It's John Boehner, it's Mitt Romney, it's Rick Perry's presidential campaign, and it's really Senate candidates from around the country who have all come through this little town in eastern Ohio for these fundraisers, where they just pick up a whole bunch of checks from these mostly middle manager, salaried employees of Murray Energy, and it's truly remarkable how. What an outsized source of contributions Murray Energy has become for a relatively small company in a relatively out-of-the-way part of the country.
Well, Alec McGillis, I saw the actual event live where you had this phalanx of these surly-looking miners. They didn't look too happy. Mitt Romney striding on the stage in front of them, and they were essentially props. And Mitt Romney said at this rally, turning to the miners, "I tell you, you've got a great boss," acknowledging Robert Murray from the stage, and he runs a great operation here. Now, Murray came to my attention back in, and I think a lot of Americans' attention, back in 2007 with the collapse of the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah, where he became a sort of overnight media celebrity, if you will, CNN, and everybody gave him a lot of airtime as this nice, avuncular guy who really cared about these people. And then we started to learn, in fact, that he's pretty ruthless and cavalier with the lives of his employees, that the Crandall mine, the inspectors tried to shut it. It was an old mine that had already been depleted and shut down, but he was essentially coming back as a scavenger to get a little bit extra out of it. And as we know, nine people died trapped below, and they've never been recovered.
Right. No, it's really quite striking that Mitt Romney would have chosen Murray Energy as the company that he was going to use as his backdrop for this big event, attacking Barack Obama as anti-coal. I mean, as you said, the Crandall Canyon was was a pretty awful event. And in fact, just last week or the week before, Murray Energy was fined, I believe, $1 million for that event. They've also been fined more recently, as well, for various Clean Water Act violations in Ohio. Quite a lot of money in that case. And then there's, you know, there's a list of other things you could point to as well, labor issues and whatnot. And then you wonder, gosh, why is Mitt Romney, you know, using them as his big ally in coal country, especially given that Mitt Romney was just a few years ago himself quite critical of coal. It was in 2003, I believe, that Romney stood outside a coal-fired plant just north of Boston and declared that he was going to shut the plant down because it was, quote, killing people. So it's for Romney now to be, you know, building such a bond, visible bond with Murray Energy is quite striking. And it's a sign both of how much Romney feels like he needs to take a pro-coal line to win in places like Ohio. It's also a sign, though, of just how valuable a fundraiser Bob Murray and Murray Energy have been. That there's a feeling among a lot of Republicans, including Mitt Romney, that he's someone that needs to be somehow recognized or repaid in some sense.
Now, Murray of Murray Energy has always been incredibly hostile towards government oversight and towards mine inspectors. He apparently, according to local media, you've written here, that he warned off mine safety inspectors with the line that Mitch McConnell, this is during the Bush administration, Mitch McConnell calls me one of the five finest men in America, and the last I checked, he was sleeping with your boss, referring to Labor Secretary Elaine Chao, the senator's wife. Now, in his letters that you got hold of, he talks about we've got to get rid of the destructive Barack Obama and his Democrat supporters. I love the way they use the word Democrat supporters, who are Hollywood characters, liberal elitists, radical environmentalists, unionists, and Americans who do not want to work. Colorful language, but I think it pretty clearly indicates his attitude, right?
Oh yeah, he's always been anti-Democrat or Democratic, as one might say. But in the last few years, he has just really ratcheted it up a lot more, because he just cannot abide Barack Obama. He really, his contempt for Obama is just very visible. He has signs, there are signs all around Murray properties, decrying Obama. There's a sign up in the lobby of the mine where that event was held, telling miners where they can call to get anti-Obama lawn signs. When you talk to Bob Murray or to others at the company, as they see it, Barack Obama and his administration are totally responsible for the troubles that the coal industry has had in the last few years. They don't want to hear about other explanations, such as this new abundance of cheap natural gas that's providing real competition for coal, and or something like the slowdown in the Chinese economy, which is also hurting the coal industry, because they've come to export a lot of coal to China. As they see it, it's just Obama and the environmental regulations clamping down on coal.
Well, apparently Murray is a climate change denier, which I think is not an inconvenient truth. It's a convenient truth for him, right?
Right.
Given what his business is. But I'm always astounded at how much and I'm sure you've noticed, Alec McGillis, that the coal industry and the coal lobby, along with the oil and gas lobby, They underwrite most of the public affairs programs on PBS and on CNN, for example, on MSNBC. I imagine they do the same on Fox. A lot of the political talk shows, the Sunday morning shows, are underwritten by coal and oil and gas companies. But in the case of the ads that Big Coal is running, which clearly are not friendly towards the Obama administration and are somewhat apocalyptic about how you know these people, I think they actually show a subliminal clip of the Occupy Wall Street people saying, you know, we've had enough rhetoric, but let's deal with reality here. We need energy and we need clean coal. Now, as far as I know, clean coal is one of the biggest lies out there, along with safe cigarettes. The fact of the matter is that clean coal, not $1 from Murray and the coal industry has ever gone into clean coal. Not $1. They keep saying that it exists, but the only work that was ever done on so-called clean coal was during the Carter administration, I understand. It was all done by the U.S. government. And it's simply, I mean, let me ask you, do you know what clean coal is? Can you?
Well, I do know what it is, and you've raised a very good point, which is that it means completely different things in these two contexts. In reality, and specifically clean coal, if there is such a thing as clean coal, it is the attempt to that is, you know, has been ongoing for a while now in certain plants and certain trial locations to basically do carbon sequester and storage, which is to somehow sequester the emissions from coal-fired plants and store them underground. This is very expensive. It's unclear if it's even doable, but there are attempts out there to see if this can be done. As you said, these attempts are government subsidized, both here and in other countries, and that's not really what the coal industry is talking about when they've got their billboards up about clean coal. They have taken that phrase clean coal, and they've sort of taken it to mean something much broader and vaguer, which is just somehow a vague notion that coal can be made clean. And I guess if you wanted to give them a good faith benefit of doubt, I suppose they could be talking about the fact that coal plants have been cleaned up in the last few years in terms of emissions other than pollutants, other than carbon. We have better scrubbers now for sulfur and whatnot. But as far as carbon emissions, global warming emissions, coal is very much not clean. And the only efforts that are being made to make it clean are these very limited government-subsidized projects that may not come to anything.
And as you pointed out earlier, Alec McGillis, what's really happening in the market is there's an enormous amount of natural gas coming online because largely from fracking. And right. It's driving the price down of natural gas. And since natural gas is pollutes over 50% less, does it not, than coal, or considerably less than coal?
Far, far, far lower carbon emissions. Yeah. And coal's plummeted. Coal was just a few years ago. Coal was providing half of our energy, for electric generation in the country. And in that number, I haven't checked just in the last few weeks, but it's down around 40 now. Maybe even lower than 40, and so they're really kind of panicking about this. The irony sort of is that the fracking boom is happening. In some cases, it's happening in the same regions as the coal decline. So you in a place like southeastern Ohio, you'll have coal mines shrinking somewhat, and coal employment shrinking somewhat at the same time as you have these other fracking operations picking up speed. But in most cases, these are separate companies, separate operations. So you'll hear Murray Energy talking about, you know, crying that the sky is falling at the same time as you've got other operations not far away that are starting to go gangbusters.
Well, just in closing, Alec McGillis, I find it pretty extraordinary that that an employer like Charles Murray can coerce his employees into supporting his particular political causes, not necessarily theirs, and they do so because he tells them not that they're going to lose their job so much that if they don't do it, Obama's going to put coal out of business, and that's why they're going to lose their job. Some apparently have approached local media, some of the miners that are coerced into that photo opportunity, and said that they were they had to lose a day's pay and were threatened if they didn't do it. I just find that kind of futile. I mean, how could the laws be so ambiguous about this? Isn't there something fundamentally wrong with that?
Again, I'll have to leave it to others to decide whether laws are violated here. I do think that you used the word wrong, and I think that's probably what a lot of people take from this, that it just seems kind of wrong that people could be pressured like this. And you're right, there is something quite old-fashioned or archaic, really, about this whole situation. In this part of the country, it does remind you of another era, really. The dominance that Robert Murray has in southeastern Ohio is what it's like from another time. He's proud of it. In fact, he's proud of the extent to which people really there do depend on him for jobs and their livelihoods, and it's paternalism in both the good and the bad senses of that. At the rally that they had for Romney, the big Romney rally where all the miners were expected to attend, they had free hot dogs and sodas for the miners' families. They even had a bunch of little amusement park rides set up for the kids. It's a world that Bob Murray really kind of rules over and rules over proudly. He's proud of knowing all of his miners' names. He always wants to introduce all of his employees to all his visiting Republican candidates. There's something almost kind of grandfatherly about his presence at this rally. But it does come with this real pressure on the political front.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alec MacGillis.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Alec MacGillis, who's a senior editor at The New Republic, serving as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy and wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, Coal Miner's Donor, A Mitt Romney Benefactor and His Surprisingly Generous Employees. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.